Hello, welcome to our LexisNexis webinar, AdTech in 2020, A Privacy Perspective. Today you'll have me, Bryony Long, from Lewis Silkin, and Jamie Drucker from Bristow's walking you through the world of AdTech. I am a partner at Lewis Silkin and I co-head the Data and Privacy Practice. I advise on a range of data protection, commercial and technology issues. But over recent years, I have a particular expertise in the field of AdTech. And work with a range of well-known brands, agencies, publishers, and ad tech vendors in this space. Over to you, Jamie.
Hi, everyone. Jamie Drucker here from Bristow's data protection team. Much like Bryony, I work on a whole range of UK and EU data protection issues with a particular focus on online behavioural advertising and all things ad tech.
Cool. So that's us. So what are we going to talk about today? This session is going to be focusing on the privacy concerns around ad tech. Now, obviously, there are lots of different things that one can talk about when we're talking about ad tech, but this session is going to really focus on the privacy. And to be honest, we've got 50 minutes, but I think both of us could talk forever on it. Although 2020 has in itself been a relatively quiet year for ad tech, because of the fact, obviously, we've had that little thing called COVID rearing its ugly head, meaning that the ICO has down tools on its investigation. There has still been a lot of activity, which we will talk through. But we will also not just focus on what happened in 2020. We also plan to look back slightly at what happened the years before and also look forward to what's going to happen in 2021 and beyond. So in particular, we are going to discuss, first of all, what do we mean by ad tech? I think, again, it means lots of things to different people, so we thought we'd classify what it meant to us. We're going to focus on particular areas of uncertainty from a data protection perspective. So in particular, we're going to have a look at social media retargeting and how RTB also works and the data privacy issues with that. We will also have a look at some of the solutions that people are presenting to get around some of the issues that have been raised in respect of RTB. And then we'll finally end on what's on the horizon for the next year or so. So moving on, what do we mean by ad tech? As I said before, ad tech obviously can mean many things to many different people. But for us, when I think of ad tech, I think of the technology or the tools that analyse and manage information, including personal data, and also deliver content for online ad campaigns. So effectively, you're looking at the technology behind a kind of end-to-end life cycle of the ad delivery process. And this process is very, very complex and often engaging multiple third parties, which is why it causes such a headache for us all from a legal and I guess commercial perspective. So it comes in lots of different guises, and I'm sure that if there are sort of ad tech experts watching this webinar, that I've probably missed a few. But the key things that I think of when I'm thinking of ad tech is paid searches. So paying advertisers, paying Google or other web browsers to ensure that their name comes up when users type in certain keywords. Social media retargeting. So, for example, brands using social media platforms to retarget their own customers on social medias or customers who look like some of their customers on social media. Real-time bidding, which is effectively enabling brands to serve ads on users as they navigate the internet. And that will be based on multiple things, including their browsing history and online behaviours. And then there's contextual advertising, which is effectively where brands are able to serve ads on users, but that will be based on the content of the particular page as opposed to user behaviour. And that is something that I think we will see quite a lot of going forward, particularly given some of the issues that are arising in some of the other areas of ad tech. So as you can imagine, this particularly social media retargeting and real-time bidding are both areas that require a significant amount of personal data processing. So we thought for this session, we will focus on these areas and look at some of the issues that we think are challenging for our clients to deal with, and looking at how our clients can navigate these murky waters from a pure data protection perspective. So social media, I'm going to talk through the social media retargeting, and then Jamie's going to take you through the real-time bidding. So what would you mean by social media retargeting? I guess for many, it just means retargeting ads through social media platforms. As I say, there are two sort of main ways that people use social media retargeting. They either use custom audiences, or they use a kind of lookalike audiences. And there are various different ways of doing this that the different social media platforms provide. But effectively, when we talk about customized audiences, we talk about where the brand effectively uploads their first party data onto the social media platform, typically in a hashed form. And the social media platform will then try and match the brand's customers with their own users. If they get a match, the social media platform will then send an ad or serve an ad on that particular user. But the ad that's being served on that user won't just, there'll be a sort of a range of ads that the brand will supply the social media platform, but the particular ad that's served on the user will actually depend on the user's behavior, for example, on the platform, inferences made by the platform about the user as well. So we talk about the idea of observed data, so data that's collected because of the way that the user behaves, and also inferred data. So again, data collected about, again, how the user behaves, but it's more drawing inferences because they've visited a particular page. And so, as you can imagine, that does involve a lot of personal data collection. When we talk about lookalike audiences, that is slightly different in the fact that it's similar in some ways, in the fact that the brand typically will upload their first party data, although not always, and then the social media platform will effectively match the user with their own users. But then rather than serve the ads on the matched users, they will serve the ads on users who look like the matched users. So effectively, they will be serving ads on or the brand ads on people that the brand has absolutely no nexus with. And that's what we mean by lookalike audiences. It's not just about uploading first party data, though. There are other ways that the social media platforms can obtain information about the users. And that can include, for example, dropping cookies or SDKs on user devices to effectively suck up data so that they can then understand how the user behaves and serve ads that way. Brands are also now increasingly, they have this first party data set, but they sort of look to enhance it. So they actually look to use third parties such as Experian to help them make sure that their targeting advertising is as really tailored and customized as possible. And so they will effectively get basically Experian to upload data directly on their behalf. And then the social media platform will also serve ads based on that data as well. So there's data coming from lots of different angles combined with the data that's already collected on the social media platform and then the ad is served. So as you can imagine, we have lots of data issues to discuss. The ICO has helpfully provided more clarity on this area, because for a long time there's been lots of issues that have been sort of flying around, but quite frankly, not many solutions on what people should be doing about it. I mean, everyone's recognised the fact that there's a lot of data being processed, but there's not really been a kind of legal framework that people are able to follow. The ICO in March earlier this year released their updated direct marketing code of practice, which addressed online behavioural advertising and social media retargeting for the first time. And in there, they provided some quite helpful guidance around what you should be thinking about. Since then, we've also had the EDPB release their draft guidelines on targeting social media users, and that was in September. So we now have two very clear guidances from the authorities on how we should be using personal data in connection with social media retargeting. The one thing that is probably worth just noting is that the ICO's draft code of practice, while it's not as anywhere near as comprehensive, it was quite firm on the view that the brands should be looking to rely on consent over legitimate interest. It didn't say you absolutely have to rely on consent, but it basically indicated that that it was in its view what you should rely on. Which is a real sort of turn up for the books for many. I mean, even though we kind of thought that may be where they might go, it still is a potentially quite challenging. What the ICO code of practice did also confirm, though, is that the sending of the retargeting advertising over social media did not technically fall under the requirements of PECA. I think for a lot of us, we thought, oh, does that count as a kind of electronic communication for the purposes of Regulation 22 of PECA? And therefore, when we serve targeted advertising, we absolutely require consent. The ICO guidance, in fact, said, no, this doesn't actually require consent under PECA, but when you're looking at legitimate interest and doing your legitimate interest assessment, in the ICO's view, this type of activity of social media remarketing isn't, in their view, in the reasonable expectation of the data subject. And so for that reason, even though you don't technically require consent for the purpose of Regulation 22 of PECA, they suggested that you still require consent because you can't get over the legitimate interest hurdle. Now, this was quite a big call from the ICO, and it has been criticised on the basis that the ICO, you know, shouldn't necessarily go as far as to say exactly whether or not consent is, and you should leave it up to us, sort of, you know, the brands and the lawyers to decide whether or not consent is required. Obviously, there are some that welcome this because they like to have clear guidelines. The EDPB, however, didn't completely sort of pare back from the ICO's view. But they did suggest that there was more of a role for legitimate interest. But that was mainly on the basis that if the targeting wasn't particularly intrusive and it wasn't focusing on vulnerable people and there was sufficient transparency and opt-outs, then there is a potential, in its view, role that we can rely on legitimate interest. So that is quite an interesting one. So we've now got these two pieces of guidance, which, you know, are the same, but also slightly different, which mean that we still are slightly in the air about which way to go. The other points that the EDPB flagged in its guidance is not just this issue of consent versus legitimate interest, but they also talked about the lack of transparency about the different actors involved in the targeting activities. And this is a key theme that I think Jamie will also talk to in his section, that, you know, it feels that this type of activity, while everyone knows it goes on, no one really knows why or how or who's involved. And I think that, you know, there is a lot to be said for really making sure that your privacy notices are as clear as they absolutely can be on how individuals' data is used. Because ultimately, the more aware the individual is of how their data is used, the more control they can exercise over it, which is fundamentally one of the fundamentals that underpins the GDPR. So I think there is a real focus in this guidance that both brands and platforms need to be really clear on how personal data is processed in connection with their activities. Another thing that was flagged by the EDPB guidance was that actually the individual has very limited ability to actually exercise control over their personal data. Now, there are certain platforms, and I won't be naming any platforms, that actually I think have taken steps to try and give more control back to the individual. But obviously, I think that the EDPB feels that there should be more should be done in this regard. And as I said previously, given controls of the data subject, in my view, is one of the absolute key principles that underpins European data protection law. So I suspect we will be seeing a lot of improvements from the platforms in allowing users to really pick and choose which ads they get served. And it is up to you as a brand, when you use these platforms, to ensure that these controls are also in place. That was something that the EDP did flag. The EDPB also talked about the fact that there was the risk of discrimination and exclusion because of the fact that there was such detailed targeting criteria, such large quantities of information being used to target the users, that there could be, as I say, discriminatory or targeting, which obviously from an ethical point of view has issues. The EDPB also said that there was a sort of real lack of clarity on the roles and responsibilities of social media platforms and controllers. Historically, social media platforms have always been very firm that they are simply acting as the brand's processor and serving the ads and using and processing the personal data in connection with those ads, serving in their capacity as a processor. The EDPB guidance actually, you know, very is in my view very clear that actually they think that now it's you know, those social media platforms are actually joint controllers with the brands. So that will mean at some point a change in the terms and a shift, you know, a general sort of shift of moving towards joint controllership. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, as and when the social media platforms start updating and how they will deal with the issues of joint controllership in respect of this type of activity. And then finally, they also mentioned that one of the other concerns they have is that there are significant amounts of special category data being processed without a lawful basis. As we all know, in order to process special category data, you have to have two processing conditions. The one first one being, say, legitimate interest or consent, but also you need to have a second processing condition. And when with special category data in this particular content, there's very few other processing conditions you can really rely on. So there is explicit consent, but given the issues that we've already talked about getting normal level consent, it's difficult to see how people are going to try and rely on explicit consent. The other one that is regularly relied on, which is again specific to special category data, is that where data has been manifestly made public by the data subject. And that is something that the EDPB guidance has actually called out and said, look, guys, it's not actually as wide as you think it is. And that there are lots of things that you need to think about when you're relying on that particular processing ground. So, for example, you need to think of you need to consider the nature of the platform. You know, is it a platform that is you know, a platform that is public, or is it more of a private platform? You also need to think about whether or not the individual has to change their settings to go from private to public, because if they've gone from private to public, then obviously that probably makes it more likely they're making that information available manifestly. But if they haven't, or if they're not required to, then it may be that they're not making that information manifestly public. Is the information, they always have to look at what is told, what is communicated to the data subject. Like, are they aware that posting information on the site is going to be publicly available? They also talk about, does the platform require you to create an account and post information sort of via your account, in which case is that really publicly manifestly being made public? And you know, is the data actually being made available by the data subject, or is it being made available by a friend, or being inferred by the platform? So there's lots of things to think about, whether or not you'd be able to actually even rely on manifestly made public, which is something that a lot of social media platforms do currently rely on, and obviously brands. So in terms of this social media retargeting guidance, and to be fair, the ICO guidance, we are still waiting for them, for both sets of guidances to be in final form. Both are sort of out of their consultation period now, and feedback has been collected. Interestingly, there has been some quite interesting feedback from various social media platforms on the EDPB guidance. And I think that, you know, the real common theme is that when you're looking at legal basis, consent versus legitimate interest, it has to be a risk-based approach in determining it. It has to depend on the facts. And you have to think about all the other things around legitimate interest, not just you just don't necessarily have to go straight down the road of consent. So it's definitely that there is still keeping that door open. I think also a few of the feedback has been that there's still, despite the fact, in my view, there's quite a lot of clarity about what the rules are, there is still significant further clarity required by the platforms and the brands as to how people are actually acting within that ecosystem. So it'll be interesting to see if either or both pieces of guidelines will be significantly updated. So that's enough from me, I think, for the time being. Jamie, like, obviously this guidance does pose lots of interesting questions. How are you finding that some of your clients are responding? Are they typically relying on legitimate interests, or are they beginning to start getting consent when they start using social media platforms to retarget advertising?
Yeah, thanks, Bryony. I suppose I would say some are moving towards a consent model, but certainly not most. I think that there's a sort of inbuilt reluctance to move to a fully consented model just because the conversion rates in terms of the number of your users, the amount of your first party data that you can pass to the social media companies is reduced significantly when you move to consent. So I would say for a number of clients, the focus has been, we're still going to do legitimate interests, but we're going to really bolster that legitimate interest assessment. We're going to make sure our transparency piece is robust. We're clear with users about the sharing. We're going to offer some fairly specific opt-out options to data subjects. And also we're going to think about things like data minimization and making sure that we're really only sharing the absolute minimum that we need to. I think the other thing that's vexing clients a bit at the moment is the joint controller piece that you were just talking about, because in most cases, they're entirely in the hands of the social media companies, the social media platforms, in terms of the terms that are in place. There's no scope to negotiate these contracts generally. So everyone's very much waiting for the social media platforms to move or to put in place the appropriate terms before they can sort of say, we've got a compliant position that lines up with the EDPB guidance. So quite a bit to think about, I suppose is how I would frame it. So I'm going to move on to look at real-time bidding. And I suppose we wanted to focus on this because it's an area that has been subject to a lot of regulatory interest, a lot of regulatory focus, not just this year, but in the last couple of years. And one of the reasons for the regulatory interest is it's also an area that vexes activists, privacy activists and campaigners. There's been a lot of consumer groups issuing complaints and writing reports on real-time bidding and on the data protection privacy challenges around real-time bidding. So just to set up the next few minutes, what I'm planning to do is spend a few minutes just talking about real-time bidding, what it is and how it works. Now, you could do hours and hours on real-time bidding and really get into the weeds of the technical makeup of the system. But I want to do it at a reasonably high level, just so we're all on the same page as to what's going on and to illustrate how data is shared around the different players in the ecosystem. I'm then going to talk about the regulatory landscape in 2020, 2018 to 2020, really, and then looking forward to 2021. That's going to focus primarily on the ICO's investigation, which, as Bryony alluded to, is paused at the moment. But I think I want to focus on that because I think it's a nice distillation of some of the issues, some of the compliance challenges with real-time bidding. Although I will touch on one or two other European regulators and what they've been up to as well. And then we're going to look at some of the proposed solutions that the industry is putting out in terms of trying to meet some of these compliance challenges. So in terms of what real-time bidding is, it's a common method used to undertake digital advertising, programmatic advertising, i.e. advertising operated through software platforms. Essentially, it allows website publishers to monetize their ad inventory and make it available to advertisers without having to go through the costly and relatively time-consuming process of arranging direct deals with those advertisers or with ad agencies. So it allows the publishers to monetize that content, and it allows advertisers to make very informed decisions about whether to bid on a particular piece of ad inventory, and crucially, on a particular user's eyeballs looking at that ad inventory, and to make that decision and decide how much they want to bid for that piece of inventory. And all of that happens through an auction process in real time. So in the time it takes for the web page and the ad content to load onto the user's browser. So I've included a diagram on the next slide. It's not my intention to go through every element of this. What I wanted to do was just use it to illustrate a typical real-time bidding transaction. So you can see the different parties involved and how data moves through, and just to illustrate some of the complexity in relation to data protection. As a kind of initial point, it's worth saying that real-time bidding has to date been underpinned by the use of cookies or the use of similar tracking technologies. And really what those cookies are doing, it's an online identifier. It's a means of indirectly identifying a specific user, attributing other data, associating other data to that indirect identifier, and then enabling advertisers and those intermediaries working for advertisers to make informed decisions about that specific user, even if they don't know who that user is, and in most cases they won't. And it's important to mention cookies and similar technologies, because it brings in this additional layer of regulation. It's not just GDPR we need to think about. It's also the e-privacy directive as implemented across a number of EU member states. And so there's specific obligations that apply in relation to consent and transparency over and above anything that the GDPR says. So just in terms of, you know, at a reasonably high level, what's happening and the different parties involved, you've got a user visiting a website. When they go on the website, they might see a consent management platform or CMP. So that's the user interface asking them for consent to cookies or telling them about what cookies are used on the site. The site is operated by a website publisher, typically, you know, for example, a newspaper that is an ad-supported publisher. And then what happens is a cookie tends to be dropped on the user's browser, and then different intermediaries in the chain will pass on what's called a bid request to the demand side of the platform. So essentially, it's the publisher and the supply side platform, or SSP, that's a platform working for the publisher, saying to the demand side or the advertiser side, we've got this specific user looking at this specific bit of content. Who wants to bid on it? How much do you want to bid on it? And that request is captured in this quite defined piece of information, this bid request, and we'll talk about what data is included within that in a minute. So you've got SSPs acting for the publisher. On the demand side, you've got demand side platforms, or DSPs. They act for the advertiser. They execute ad buys, and they read bid requests and make decisions about what to bid. And again, when I say make decisions, we're talking about an algorithm making a decision in real time rather than human intervention. You've got in the blue boxes at the bottom these two, you've got this additional type of organization, data management platforms, or DMPs, and these are quite important from a data protection perspective, because what the DMPs do, both for the SSP and for the DSP, so both the demand side and the supply side, is they layer in additional information to build the profile of the user who's looking at the particular piece of ad inventory. So, for example, they might take a cookie ID. The DMP might enable you to match that cookie ID to other similar cookie IDs, to layer in demographic information about that individual, income brackets, you know, significant enrichment of the data, so that by the time it gets across to the demand side, to the agencies and to the advertisers, they have a much better idea of the type of person that might be looking at the ad. Within the red box, that's just illustrating that typically the actual transaction, the ad sale, the ad buy, takes place within an ad exchange, which is like a marketplace for the real-time bidding ad. And then not shown on this diagram, but you're likely to have a range of other specialist intermediaries feeding into the system as well. So, for example, you might have ID resolution providers. You might have organizations trying to prevent click fraud. You'll certainly have conversion measurement specialist providers, so tracking through the success of an advertising campaign, so it goes both ways. And so what you can see is that there's a level of complexity here. And just to make it even more complicated, the next slide, I've got a wider diagram. So obviously in the previous slide, we're looking at, you know, a publisher, an SSP, a DSP, a DMP. In reality, a particular piece of ad inventory is made available to multiple SSPs. Each one might talk to multiple ad exchanges, multiple DSPs involved bidding on the data, plugging into different DMPs. You know, you get lost in acronym hell. But what I'm trying to show here is that for any particular piece of ad inventory, multiple parties are bidding on it. So multiple parties are reading the data contained in the bid request, even if they're ultimately unsuccessful. Just to give a bit of a flavor of the key players involved, I've put up some examples here. Obviously, there's a huge range of intermediaries from large to big, but you can see, you know, the advertisers are fairly obvious. The large publishers that have a lot of ad inventory to monetize tend to be the larger news organizations that run an ad-supported model. And then just picking out a couple of other things, you can obviously see certain organizations are involved in multiple different stages here. So Google, you know, runs its own ad exchange, also works on the demand side with Ad Manager, works on the supply side with DoubleClick for publishers, and so is playing multiple roles in the ecosystem. So obviously has a significant amount of influence in terms of, you know, the decisions they make around the compliance posture. You've also got some of the larger, you know, telecoms conglomerates. So, you know, AT&T are involved through AppNexus, Verizon obviously involved. And then unsurprisingly, big players like Amazon and Facebook, very heavily involved in different parts of this ecosystem. And then some of the sort of traditional data insight companies like Nielsen, really feeding in that insight data through the operation of a DMP, so that by the time the data gets to the advertiser, they've got a pretty clear picture or a pretty good picture of who the user is in terms of their attributes. And in terms of, so we can already see quite a lot is being shared with quite a lot of people. What's being shared? So we talked about the bid request. The exact nature of the bid request is determined by industry protocols. So for example, the IAB's open RTB protocol or the Google authorized buyers RTB protocol. So that specifies the fields that are included in a bid request that the different vendors and ultimately the advertiser and the advertiser's agency can read. So it tends to be, I'm not going to go through all of these points, but it tends to be a mixture of an identifier or a series of identifiers, and that might be a cookie ID or a unique tracking ID, and then some profile information built around that ID around the user. So that might be brought in from data brokers through the DMP, so income brackets, age, etc. There'll also be some contextual information about the website that the user is visiting. What is the content that this ad sits within? What is the user, how has the user interacted with that content previously? What pages has that user been to before? And perhaps sort of more controversially, if you look at the last point, within these data broker segments, and in particular within information about the websites that the specific user has been on, it might be possible to infer some things about the user that are reasonably sensitive. So things, you know, if they're going on particular pages around certain health conditions, it might tell you something about their medical conditions. Similarly, sexual orientation or political views. So we're sort of in the territory of special category data as well. And as I'll come on to in a minute, that's been something that has certainly exercised the ICO. So that is a reasonably high level overview of RTB, what it is and what data gets shared. I thought we'd just spend a few minutes doing a bit of a snapshot of regulatory scrutiny of real-time bidding, you know, 2018 to 2020, and allow us to look forward to 2021 as well. I will focus particularly on the ICO investigation, because I think it's a nice distillation of the key compliance challenges with real-time bidding. But just to touch on some of the other European regulators have been up to as well. The CNIL, so that's the French data protection regulator, has been quite busy in this area, probably from the second half of 2018 onwards. So initially, after GDPR came into force, the CNIL was fairly focused on a number of smaller ad tech players, tended to be quite mobile-centric, so mobile device-centric ad tech players, and it was looking very closely at their consent practices in terms of user consent on apps. So they issued enforcement action against a number of organizations, including Vectory, FizzUp, Teemo. And really what they were concerned about was these organizations relying on fairly broad and general consents to the data processing they were undertaking. They were also concerned about things like the use of pre-ticked boxes, so defaulting privacy settings so that data is collected without the user actively choosing for that to be the case. There was also a bit of a focus on the use of real-time location data within some of these mobile apps to target advertising off the back of the use of that location data. And now in 2018, the CNIL was issuing enforcement notices. So it's basically saying to the industry, your consent practices aren't up to scratch, you need to improve. Where we've got to now with the CNIL is they're taking some pretty serious action. So they issued some detailed cookies guidance last year, but now literally in the last week or two, we've seen two fairly whopping fines issued against Google and Amazon for failure to comply with e-privacy requirements on the use of cookies. So Google was fined 100 million euros. So we're talking very, very significant fines, 100 million euros across two different group companies for failures in relation to cookies. So that was around placing advertising cookies or allegedly placing advertising cookies prior to presentation of cookie choices to a user. Also complaints about poor transparency for users. So they weren't told really what the advertising cookies were doing and they didn't have a sufficient opportunity to control the use of those cookies. Amazon, very similar e-privacy cookie consent issues, slightly lower fine, 35 million euros, but you know, fairly blockbuster stuff in terms of the numbers we're talking about. And interestingly, these were not GDPR enforcement actions. These were e-privacy enforcement actions. So quite cleverly, the French have got round some of the procedural aspects of the GDPR in terms of the one-stop shop, which would normally say if you're issuing a GDPR enforcement action, the local lead supervisory authority for these organizations, which tends to be the Irish, would have the power to issue to take enforcement action. Whereas in this case, by going down the e-privacy route, the CNIL have managed to take their own action. Now, watch this space on these ones. I think it's quite likely we're going to see some appeals just because of the numbers involved and what's at stake. So that might be something to look forward to in 2021. Just a word about the Irish. Again, the Irish is increasingly an important regulator in this space because a number of the larger technology companies have their European base in Dublin. So Facebook, Twitter, Google. The Irish did a cookie sweep late last year, which was basically checking in on about 40 different organizations, looking at what their cookie consent practices were, and then wrote some guidance off the back of that. And it's fair to say they were reasonably unimpressed with the level of compliance with e-privacy consent and transparency requirements. So they were finding, again, similar to the Google CNIL piece, dropping of cookies before consent landing pages have popped up, use of pre-tick boxes, poor design of cookie banners and pop-ups so that users are confused about what cookies are being used and why. Now, that was just guidance. Off the back of that, we think it's reasonably likely that we're going to see some actual enforcement action from the DPC next year. They are already writing to organizations off the back of the cookie sweep and asking them to explain their practices. So I think we're likely to see some enforcement action going forward. Just a word about the Germans as well. I think we're seeing increasing coordination between the various German data protection authorities, which there are a number of them because of the federal system in Germany. We've seen some guidance on guidance for publishers on the use of cookies and real-time bidding, and some fairly firm statements on the consent requirements. So quite a lot going on across Europe, quite a significant amount of enforcement action already. And I just want to spend a few minutes talking about what the ICO were up to over the last couple of years and where things are with that now. And it's worth just saying that the ICO investigation is in some ways a little bit broader, because it doesn't just talk about consent and transparency, although that is a big focus. It takes in a number of other areas of GDPR compliance issues as well. So the ICO, but before we jump into the ICO update report, just some background on the investigation itself and where things are up to. This area was already highlighted as a regulatory enforcement priority for the ICO in its 2018 to 2021 enforcement strategy. But I think it was really kickstarted in September to November 2018 when we had complaints issued by Brave and consumer rights group, the Open Rights Group, and also some complaints made by Privacy International as well, really focusing very heavily on the real-time bidding system, the whole ecosystem, the compliance challenges around that, and picking out one or two of the key players as well. So the ICO was under an awful lot of pressure at the outset to act post the GDPR coming into force. That being said, I think the ICO, at least initially, were of the view that any enforcement action it took could have a very significant impact on an industry under some strain. So publishers are, website publishers and newspapers are obviously under a lot of pressure, financially, and looking to monetize their content, and the ICO didn't want to move too quickly. So I'd say initially, the ICO were really in listening mode rather than enforcement mode. So they had a big fact-finding day in London last year, where they brought together publishers, advertisers, lawyers, civil society, consumer groups, and they had basically a big session where everyone talked about some of the challenges around ad tech and real-time bidding. Now, off the back of that, they published this report in June 2019, and this really set out a number of key areas where they felt the industry wasn't meeting the requirements of the GDPR. And you can see here that the suggestion was that the ad tech industry, as compared to other industries, for example, financial services, was incredibly immature in terms of its compliance posture for GDPR. And the message in June 2019 was, here are the problems, go away, you've got 6 months to fix it. And if you don't fix it in the next 6 months, then we're going to look to take intervention and take some enforcement action. So we were geared up over the course of 2019 to see some enforcement action sort of in the early part of 2020. And certainly the ICO was fairly active in reaching out to organizations and proactively asking questions and getting them to, so they were doing a bit of a deep dive in terms of information gathering. Now, COVID-19 came along, nothing really happened for a while. And then in May this year, the ICO announced that it was pausing its ad tech investigation, really didn't want to be seen to be putting undue pressure on any industry in light of the pandemic. So the status of the investigation is uncertain at this stage. We don't know where it's going to get to. I don't think it's going away forever, certainly, but we don't quite know the posture that the ICO will take going forward. Unsurprisingly, some of the privacy groups are a bit unimpressed with the ICO in terms of the pause of the investigation. And in November, the Open Rights Group said it was going to be taking the ICO to court to force their hand to take some more serious enforcement action of the sector. So that's where we are, but I think it's still worth looking at what the update report found in terms of the key issues, because that sort of leads us in to think about what some of the solutions might be. So what was the issue with real-time bidding? I think we can break it up into eight pieces, and I'll just briefly touch on each one. So the first point is special category data, and I touched on this before. The real-time bidding protocols, and in terms of the data that's included in the bid request, do allow, in some instances, information to be provided which falls within certain fields which are special category data. So, for example, political views or religious beliefs. And whilst a number of organizations said the reason that information is shared is because advertisers want to know, from a brand safety perspective, which websites a user is coming from so they know whether particular ads are going to be suitable, the ICO also had some evidence that this type of information was also being used for targeting or excluding certain users from targeting. And the point here is, as Bryony said before, if we're in the territory of special category data, you need not just an Article 6 condition under GDPR, but an Article 9 additional basis for processing. And really the only one here is explicit consent. So that's a higher standard of consent. And the ICO's view was nothing they'd seen from a consent management perspective across websites really came to the level of explicit consent for special category data. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, as you would have seen from the diagrams I was showing before, there's a very significant amount of participants in the ecosystem across all the different range of intermediaries. And even in more, shall we say, regulated areas, so we'll come on to talk about the transparency and consent framework in a minute, but even in relation to those more regulated frameworks, we're still talking about, you know, hundreds and hundreds of intermediaries that might see data. And that's been a big emphasis of the consumer rights complaints, that the Brave Group really categorizing this mass volume of participants as enabling a data breach, effectively. Data is just flowing everywhere with no control. And therefore, they sort of categorize it as a data breach. And the ICO is concerned about this idea of data leakage. So if the data spreads to too many people, to too many organizations, you just entirely lose control of who might access it and when and what they're allowed to do with it. An absolutely core issue, similar to the social media retargeting we were talking about earlier, an absolutely core issue is whether you need consent for, you know, the sharing of the bid requests, or whether there's some role for legitimate interests. And the ICO said two really important things, which I think made a lot of people sit up. One is, if you need consent to place a cookie, which you do because of e-privacy requirements, their view is consent would be the appropriate lawful basis for all subsequent processing of that cookie ID and the data associated with that cookie ID. So they said it's not open to you to get consent for the cookie, but then to rely on legitimate interests and to swap between consent and legitimate interests. The second point they said more broadly was they don't think that you can rely on legitimate interests for real-time bidding generally. And just the nature of the ecosystem is such that there's too much data sharing going on, and it's too far outside the reasonable expectations of the user to enable you to rely on legitimate interests. In relation to e-privacy specifically, there was some evidence that some organizations were attempting to rely on legitimate interest for the placement of the cookie itself, and the ICO said, no, you can't do that. Transparency is a fundamental issue. So a lot of players, it's quite an opaque ecosystem. Users don't really have any idea that their data is being shared in this way. Quite often what you would see as a user presented at best with a long list of vendors that might be processing their data, and then links to 100 different privacy notices for each one of those vendors. And the ICO's point is, how is a user supposed to navigate 100 different privacy notices and have any idea what's happening to their data? And linked in with that is the issue of data subject rights. If a user doesn't know who's got their data, doesn't know how their data is shared, how is a user supposed to get access to their data, or object to the use of data, or ask an organization to erase their data? So there's a sort of minimization of the ability of the user to exercise their rights. A couple of other points that I think are important. Data retention, again, it's linked with the size of the ecosystem. So if there's so many people involved, how can you put in place any kind of technical controls on how long data can be kept for? And lastly, and I think this is a really crucial point, data protection impact assessments, DPIAs. The ICO clearly sees these as absolutely fundamental to demonstrating compliance with the data shared through the various intermediaries, and is expecting organizations probably not just have one real-time bidding DPIA, but to have a very considered approach to a range of DPIAs covering their core activities. And interestingly, not so much in the 2019 report, but more recently, there were certainly some statements from the ICO that they were pretty unimpressed with the DPIAs that they'd seen to date, in terms of the level of detail and whether they were sort of genuinely teasing out the risks to users of the real-time bidding system. So the Transparency and Consent Framework, or TCF, is an initiative of the European arm of the Internet Advertising Bureau, or IAB. It is a technical solution built by industry itself, effectively, and it's designed to meet GDPR requirements, but also the e-privacy requirements, with a focus on user consent, transparency, and also data minimization in terms of the amount of sharing that goes on with the various vendors. The building blocks of the transparency and consent framework are effectively some open source specifications for sharing signals from users around what they've seen and what they're consenting to and what they're objecting to, so that everyone in the ecosystem is reading that information and those requests in the same way. That's the first piece. There are some detailed policy and registration requirements for publishers, intermediaries, consent management platforms, and various other users, so that everyone is signing up to the same level playing field in terms of what they should be doing around how they read these consent signals and how they use the data. It has an approved vendor list, which admittedly is still very long. It's about 450 vendors. So those are the vendors that are saying, we can read the consent signals and we will adhere to the policies of the transparency and consent framework. And then finally, the final sort of building block of it is a quite granular set of requirements in terms of the user interface. So what the user sees when they come on a website, what options are surfaced to them, and how they can exercise their choices. Now, the consent string is the heart of this. So that is a string of code that tells the vendors what users have consented to, and it's split up between purposes and vendors. So the idea is that if I go on a website, I can say, I'm happy with my data being used for analytics purposes and content personalization, but I'm not happy with it being used for ad personalization and targeted advertising. And I've looked down the list of vendors and I want vendor 1, 2, 3, and 4, but I want to turn off vendors 5, 6, and 7. So the idea is the TCF allows users to exercise a very granular level of control and push that consent signal out. So when the data is shared through this ecosystem, all the parties know what they should be doing with it, whether they're allowed to use it and for what purposes. Now, this has become an issue in 2020 because whilst the TCF was launched in 2018, version 2 of the TCF was launched in 2019 and has been rolled out through 2020. This really expands out the number of purposes that are available for users to exercise choice over. So we're now up to 10 purposes, 2 special purposes, plus various features and special features. So there's quite a lot going on in terms of what the user sees and the choices they can make. Couple of other things in version 2, they've tried to make a more complete accommodation of legitimate interests. So users can not only consent for some vendors, but in some cases, vendors will say, we actually process the data on the basis of legitimate interests. And the idea is users can see that and object, make an objection to the legitimate interest rather than a consent choice. It also gives some more granular controls to users in terms of the vendors it switches them on or off rather than just doing it on a grouped basis. So there's lots of time and effort that's gone into implementing TCF version 2, both at a vendor level and a publisher level. But I think it's fair to say there's a number of limitations still that mean there's a lot more work to do. The first thing is this is a voluntary mechanism only. So it's sending out a signal of the user's preferences, saying I consent to this purpose or I consent to this vendor, but there's no technical measure in there that actually prevents the vendor from processing the data if they've been told not to, or for processing the data for a particular purpose if they've been told not to. So they adhere to registration requirements and specifications, but there's nothing preventing them from using the data more widely. And there isn't anything preventing a publisher from having vendors on their website that are non-IAB vendors. So again, you've still got this issue of data leakage. You've got a very extensive vendor list. So again, 450. So too many players in the ecosystem from the ICO's perspective. And there's quite a lot of confusion, I think, built into TCF as well. So you've got various purposes, and I gave a couple of examples before, ad personalization, content personalization, profiling. But you've also got this overarching first purpose, which is intended to meet the e-privacy requirement to get consent for the use of cookies. So you give consent for cookies, but it doesn't say why the cookies are being used. And then you have a number of other purposes, like ad personalization, which seemingly are dependent on the consent for cookies, but the interaction between the two isn't crystal clear. So you've got this scenario where a user might consent to ad personalization, but not consent to the use of cookies, which leaves vendors in a difficult position in terms of what they are and aren't allowed to do in relation to that user. I think the legitimate interest point is quite confusing as well. Now, obviously, the ICO is skeptical of the ability to rely on legitimate interests anyway. But you've now essentially got a position where a user could see a list of vendors and it says some of them rely on consent, some of them rely on legitimate interest. Where they rely on consent, a user is being asked to opt in. Where they rely on legitimate interest, a user is being asked, do you object? So it's effectively an opt-out. So you've got this mix of opt-ins and opt-outs, which is just, you know, fairly confusing for users in terms of how to approach this. From the perspective of the publishers and the consent management platforms implementing the TCF, is very prescriptive in terms of what you have to say in your cookie banners and pop-ups, including what you say in your first level initial pop-up. There's quite a lot of information that the TCF requires you to include. So there's just this risk that the whole system is overly complex for users and overly burdensome for publishers and CMPs. That being said, for a long time, it's probably been the only game in town. There are challenges with it. I think probably I've been talking for long enough, so I'll just sort of frame this to Bryony. Given the challenges and the limitations with the transparency and consent framework, are there other options out there, or do you think really where we're heading is a return to more contextual advertising?
Well, thanks, Jamie. I mean, there are other options out there, but quite frankly, they're not particularly obvious. I have to say, I have a slide on this because I thought you might be asking me this question. We do have one option, which is what I like to refer to as the Johnny Ryan approach. Johnny Ryan is the individual behind the Brave complaint, which kickstarted the whole ICO investigation. And he has been very, very vocal around on his view of RTB and the issues around it. In fact, when he actually submitted the complaint, he actually wrote a very long piece all around online behavioural advertising, which, you know, really brought to life some of the issues in his view. But his ultimate view is the way to get around this is to just take personal data out of the equation. And as Jamie sort of suggests, you know, maybe go down the contextual route. That is a view, but it's going to be a very uncommercial view. Looking at other potential options, there was a hope that blockchain might come and save the day, but the ICO, as far as I'm aware, hasn't seen any kind of technology that is going to particularly address some of the issues. I've personally worked with a couple of clients who've looked into the more kind of data management and some supply chain management, effectively tools that shine a light through the supply chain and actually allow enforcement through the supply chain. Which, you know, are very interesting, but they only deal with one issue that the ICO has raised. It doesn't deal with, for example, the consent issue or the issues around use of special data. So, it is very much, I think, going to be a combination of things. Finally, I guess there's always just the approach of just sticking within certain walled gardens, because there you can control the number of players, you can minimise the risk of special data being collected, you can keep it secure. You can, you know, minimize data leakage, and you can get, you know, decent consent and explain to users how it all works. But the problem with walled gardens is that obviously just ends up playing into the hands of the big players. So it doesn't necessarily drive competition. So I think this is very much of an area of TBD, but an interesting one nevertheless. So looking forward, what's on the horizon for 2021? I mean, I think that we are going to see more regulatory action. I think that the regulators have been quiet in the sort of last few years, but we are now seeing them beginning to roar. As Jamie mentioned earlier, the CNIL is particularly roaring at the moment with their significant fines against Amazon and Google. But they're also looking into Criteo, who is a well-known ad tech vendor, and they've sort of accusing Criteo of being in breach of effectively Article 9, so basic GDPR principles around transparency, lawful basis and purpose limitation. So that will be a really interesting decision, and I suspect quite a lot of the issues that Jamie's already talked about in the ICO investigation will probably get raised. But I think now we've got this actual finding, when we get the actual finding, I think people will take it a lot more seriously. We've also got the potential class actions as well on the horizon. Now, this is something that me and my team have been sort of saying for a while, is that, yes, the fines are big, but the class actions are even more potentially eye-watering. So at the moment, we've got, you know, and these are very much, they're not, in the US, class actions are very familiar. In Europe, they're not as familiar at the moment. So, you know, they are slowly getting off the ground, but they are beginning to roll. And the latest one is a sort of 9 billion class action brought against Salesforce and Oracle by the Privacy Collective, which is a European non-profit organization. And they've effectively said, accusing Salesforce and Oracle of collecting user data without consent and auctioning it off to other companies. Again, you know, that's actually been something that's been filed in both the UK and Holland and could have massive, massive implications. I think they were suggesting that each affected data subject is potentially could award damages of £500, and we need times that by the amount of people. You know, it gets significant. So, you know, there is that on the horizon, and there are other class actions sort of just waiting in the wings, so I've heard. We've also got the e-privacy regulation, which something that was meant to come in at the time of GDPR and has yet to rear its ugly head. Say ugly head, but rear its head. We did have, so what has been interesting is that there's been a change of presidency, and so where the Croatian presidency, they released a draft. They actually suggested that there would be more of a way forward for legitimate interest when processing cookie data, which I think suddenly gave a few more people within the ad tech ecosystem a bit of sort of light at the end of a gloomy tunnel. But unfortunately for them, the German council have now taken over, and they've produced a draft which has very much shut the door on legitimate interest. So, you know, and gone back firmly to the view that consent is the way forward for use of cookies. What they have done, though, which I think is interesting and I think possibly will be welcomed by publishers, is they have given the option for potential cookie walls, effectively allowing publishers to have paid for and free options. But obviously the only way they could do that is if they obviously provide a decent alternative. So it's, you know, a freely given consent. I think that's the issue with consent, is it's not, in an ad tech world, not always freely given. So, you know, that could be really interesting, because I know some of the publisher clients I've worked with are really struggling at the moment with the ICO's quite an anti-cookie wall view. So that could be welcomed. We also have the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act, which is sort of hot off the press. The draft was released on the 15th of December, so only very recently. And that effectively sets out sort of a pair of rules which have all kind of arisen from the investigation, or CMA investigation, into sort of digital services platforms. And effectively, these pieces of legislation are aimed to create safer digital space and establish a level playing field. But what they do is really draw out the thing that I talked about at the beginning of this session around transparency and making users really, really clear on exactly how their data is being processed, and also real focus on giving control to the users and giving users effective recourse mechanisms. And then there's also increased reporting obligations. So we've got that as well. And then just looking at other kind of non-legal, I guess, issues, we've got like new approaches by major players in the market. So we've got Google Chrome, who've announced that they are going to be ending support for third-party cookies in their Chrome browser by early 2022, unless the media or marketing companies develop other kind of tracking, the more lawful tracking methods. So that will obviously have a huge impact on this industry if people can't find alternative ways to track. We've also got Apple, who have now said in their latest iOS 14, they've now said that there's going to be a kind of off by default setting. So customers or users of Apple devices will have to actually opt in to allow developers to actually access the advertising identifier effectively on their devices, which again will have a real impact on people collecting data for the purposes of online behavioural advertising. There's also Verizon, who again very recently announced as a sort of alternative to cookies that it's going to be using a kind of solution which will help marketers improve targeting, but it will be using Verizon's first party data. So it will be collecting data across all of its online properties and amalgamating that together and then creating or capturing digital signals to create identity graphs. So again, that's sort of another tech solution to try and circumvent some of the cookie rules or some of the cookie issues. So we'll see where that goes. So, I mean, those are just some of the things that are going on. As I say, you know, we will, I think 2021 has is going to be a very interesting year for the world of ad tech. I think also Jamie did mention that the ICO investigation, whilst it's, you know, paused momentarily, it will get up and running. And actually the there has been sort of a legal action brought against it for not taking, you know, that there will be seeing a lot more things to happen in 2021. So I guess, what do you need to think about when you're engaging in ad tech? I mean, the key thing, which, you know, if you take anything from this seminar, is transparency. You know, really trying to explain in your privacy notices exactly how you're engaging and who you're engaging and how the data is being used. And, you know, when you are engaging in social, like either social media retargeting or online behavioral advertising, you are, you know, really asking questions of the providers with that you are engaging with, so that making sure that they are equally as transparent as you. You also obviously need to make a decision about what your lawful basis is going to be. And while I hope we've provided some useful insights on the two sort of ways of going, you know, ultimately, you know, there isn't an absolute black or white answer yet. So there's still going to have to be some calls made. But, you know, I think implementing compliant cookie consent tools is very much the first step. And, you know, if you're still hanging on to implied consent, I think that is probably something you should be addressing as a matter of priority in 2021. As just mentioned, you should also make sure that when you are engaging in either social media retargeting or online behavioural advertising, that you do a proper due diligence on the players that you are effectively working with. And if you are obtaining data from, say, third-party data aggregators or third-party data vendors, you should be making sure that that data has been lawfully collected. I mean, obviously, you can't do in-depth audit, but you should at least be asking the questions and stress testing where the data is coming from. I think the fact that you can't obviously ever 100% know, but you do need to be asking the questions and you need to evidence that, because unfortunately just saying, oh, I got my data from you know, Nielsen, that, and you know, I just assume they would be compliant, you know, isn't going to be a well-received answer by a regulator if should they start investigating you. So you need to be demonstrating your due diligence, and that is super, super important. I think it's also looking at the various roles of the parties and understanding, you know, who, whether or not you're joint controllers, and looking to update your contracts. Again, Jamie mentioned earlier around one of the issues is that social media platforms are still very much presenting themselves with as processors, and as we all know, trying to negotiate against those sort of big players is near on impossible. That said, the EDPB guidance on social media, on retargeting social media users, has been very clear that, again, that is not an excuse for non-compliance. Like, we need, as brands, we need to be pushing the platforms if they're not taking steps to update their terms and conditions and identifying themselves in the correct roles. Then we should be taking steps to you know, ensure that is not the case. You know, take that with what you will, but it has been very much clear in the guidance that we need to do more rather than just simply say they're non-negotiable, we'll just go with what the platforms say. And the same point with ensuring robust contracts are in place. Again, you know, we don't have the ability to always negotiate some of these contracts with some of the big players, but again, that doesn't necessarily absolve you of liability. So you do need to be really trying to get as much in your contracts to ensure that, you know, everyone down the chain is processing data as lawfully as they should be doing, and as I say, complying with the GDPR principles. And finally, DPIAs. The ICO has talked about it ad nauseum. You know, it was something that I think everyone, when GDPR came in, thought, what is a DPIA? How do I do one? Oh, it sounds like a lot of faff. I'm just going to ignore it. It really is. If you're engaging in any kind of online behavioral advertising or social media retargeting, you know, you absolutely need one in place. Now, as I say, the ICO has yet in its view to see one in particular in respect of online behavioral advertising, which it thinks is adequate, but at least you should be doing it. If you have absolutely nothing to show, then, you know, that will not stead you in a very good light. And, you know, I've worked with various sort of associations within sort of agency associations and publishing associations who are actually trying to help their members come up with ways of doing DPIA. So there is quite a lot of help out there. There's a lot of guidance out there issued by the ICO. So, you know, there is absolutely no excuse for not doing them, and you really should be doing them as a matter of priority. So I think that's all for us. I'm sorry we may have gone slightly over time, but hopefully you found it really useful. Because of the way that we are operating at the moment, we don't obviously have the live questions, but, you know, if you want to get in contact with Jamie or myself on any of the things we've talked about in this session, we'd be more than happy to answer. As you can probably tell, both of us are very passionate about this area and, you know, relish the legal challenges that it poses. So, you know, if there is anything we can do to help you navigate it, we'd be delighted.